I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. Quite often, at least for me, the way the lectionary compiles the Sunday selection of biblical readings can seem very arbitrary. Not always, but quite often. It's like each week being presented with a conundrum made from the fragments of a larger puzzle, which, as the preacher, I'm tasked to try to piece together in order for our community to hear the conversation that God is inviting us into. And it seems to me that in the arrangements of the texts, it's the Old Testament and the Gospel readings that alert us to the nature of God's timely invitation. The Psalm and the New Testament readings appear, at least to me, as side commentaries, often angling outwards at a tangent. At first sight, the lectionary's Old Testament choice of the story of Joseph and his reunification with his brothers seems to wing into our awareness towards the end of the story cycle. Of course, we know about Joseph, the boy with the coat of many colors, who arouses the envy and jealousy of his brothers, who sell him into slavery in Egypt, where after ups and downs, he becomes Pharaoh's prime minister. So why does the lectionary choose this point in the Joseph story for us to hear today? The book of Genesis is a book of origins. The patriarch stories that form the last part of the book are a construction of a history from Abraham through Jacob, preparing for Exodus and Moses. The story of Isaac is a link story, providing a continuity through the fiction of father, son, and grandson that links Abraham to Jacob. The Joseph cycle does the same at the end of the book, and it links Jacob to the Exodus event and to Moses. The patriarch stories are independent. They're separate memory fragments from the older Hebrew oral tradition. And they're woven together by later authors into a discourse that speaks much more about the issues facing the time of the authors, some 500 years after the stories, the setting that the stories are placed in. These stories are set around the 13th to the 12th century before the Common Era. But the Bible's purpose in telling them in this way relates more to the politics and the ideologies of the 6th and 5th century BCs. The recording of these ancient memory fragments into a continuous narrative is a device that the later authors use to create a multi-generational family story to speak about the nature of race and community. Genesis ends with the death of Joseph. But before he dies, he compels his brothers under oath to return with his bones to the land that God promised to Abraham. And the book of Exodus, the next one in the series, opens with establishing Joseph's brothers, the sons of Jacob, as the ancestors of the 12 tribes of Israel. But it seems that Joseph's brothers don't leave Egypt. They stay and they prosper. In fact, they prosper rather too well, causing the Egyptians to fear them. Note, it's fear that always precedes hatred. And in the 8th verse of the first chapter of Exodus, it begins with a very ominous sentence. It says, "Now a new king arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph." And the scene is now set for the enslavement of Joseph's descendants as the preface for the rise of Moses and the Exodus event. And so today we drop in, as it were, on Joseph revealing his true identity to his brothers, leading to a tearful reunion and reconciliation. Again, why this piece of the bigger story? Well, thinking back about that link between the Old Testament and the Gospels, it's chosen clearly to fit with Luke's portrayal of Jesus teaching love your enemies, opening up the complex dynamics of the golden rule, do unto others, not as they do to you, but as you would have them do to you. Joseph becomes the exemplar of the power of love to triumph over fear. Fear and resentment, paving the way for reconciliation for those who might more easily have remained estranged. And as the truth comes out, Joseph has every reason to hate his brothers for what they did to him. And his brothers have every reason to fear Joseph's revenge, their kid brother, whom they have so grievously wronged. But that's not what happens. The choice of this fragment in the Joseph cycle illustrates Luke's Jesus's teaching. It is only love your enemies that offers a cure capable of breaking the age-old cycles of repetitive violence. A timely message for us living in a society where personal relationships have become poisoned by fear, fear of one another. Once upon a time, our fear of otherness focused on external actors, others not like us. Today, we fear our neighbors next door as the ones who are now not like us. Even family members have come to fear one another. Estrangements inflamed by conspiracy theories peddled by social media influencers. We are becoming a society in which the members increasingly no longer recognize one another. Contested truth, contested realities, poison, new perceptions, paving the way for new cycles of repetitive violence. Gil Bailey is a commentator I like very much. He writes in the tradition of René Girard, and he writes about the Luke passage in this way. He says, In other words, don't do to others as they do to you, but as you would have them do to you. Doing unto others as they do to you is the old world of reciprocity. Jesus asks us to do as you would have them do. Love your enemies. Why? Because they're really nice people? Probably not. And he ends by saying that this is the most radical thing in the gospel. You see, there's nothing sentimental in the teaching of Jesus. His is a hard teaching. Hard in the sense that it's difficult to put into practice, and hard in its stark lack of sentimental warm fuzziness. Another writer, James Breach, in his book, The Silence of Jesus, says, Jesus is the most loving and least sentimental man one could imagine. Love your enemies is not sentimentality. This is something that goes right to the heart. Jesus says, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. And then watch what happens. This is a recipe for destroying the little bundle of lies about myself and my society that come into existence the moment my tribe and I find somebody to hate. And following this injunction is not just a nice thing to do. It's a matter of destroying the whole system of mystification, which has been the womb in which we've lived and moved and had our existence. It's not just about the interpersonal relationships that we have with each other. It's a recipe for the deconstructing of the whole business of repetitive violence. Do unto others as you would have them do to you is the only antidote for combating the lies fueled by fear. The lies our fear tells us about ourselves and our neighbors. And following Jesus' teaching is not just a nice thing to do. It's the only way to expose the fear hiding in plain sight. The cycles of repetitive violence stem from the way we mask and mystify the extent of the fear that lurks at the bottom of our hearts. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Is not the nice Christian thing to do. It is the only thing to do. And this is a hard teaching. Hard as in the difficulty to practice. It goes against all our natural instincts. And it's hard as in it's the very opposite of a kind of pious masochism that sentimentalizes, turn the other cheek, and enjoy being beaten up. The first step to implementing this teaching has nothing to do with love. At least not love as we understand the meaning of that word. It's not about being nice. The first step is simply to refuse any longer to be afraid. as John O'Donohue puts it, to waste our hearts on fear no more. In the practice of loving our enemies, treating others as we would wish them to be treated by them, the 20th century Benedictine monk and poet Sebastian Moore says something like this. Jesus lures us in and arouses our desire for him. We are caught up in being fascinated by each other, and he steps in to catch our fascination. He came in, and he can get out. Out, that is, from the entrapment within repetitive cycles of reciprocal violence. This brings new meaning to the invitation to follow him. Amen.